I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source. On the chance that we'll be asked someday, in effect, Grandma, Grandpa, were you there in 2016 for the Trump quake? The shock of a new language, new alignments, a new landscape of hopes and fears under the old stars and stripes? Did you have any idea what it was the end of or the start of? We're seeding those questions this hour. The premium is on wild guesses from people we would call wise, or at least thoughtful. A law professor who teaches in Italy and San Francisco wants to argue that the Donald Trump election marks the death of democracy, snuffed by organized money, about as free as Soviet state capitalism. To the contrary, a Brazilian visionary who was taught for a lifetime in Cambridge says, no, the Trump choice was better than the technocratic alternative and could still be an opening to our seething energy and the prophetic American visions of Lincoln, Whitman, and Franklin Roosevelt. We begin with the storyteller Jill Lepore, prolific Harvard historian of the American past, a star witness in the New Yorker magazine to what she watched unfolding week to week this year. By the end, she was hearing the voice of the defiant ex-slave Frederick Douglass from our Civil War time, 1862.
I was thinking, well, what is there to say about the outcome of this election? And what are other moments when people have wrestled with a sudden change, an unexpected change? And just purely because I'm writing this history of the United States from 1492 to 2016.
Wow.
And I'd just gotten through writing the Civil War parts. I was thinking about this speech that Douglass gave in 1862 called The Reasons for Our Troubles. Not many months in to the Civil War, but it's already devastating, shocking, tragic. And Douglass looks around at the reasons that people have been giving, and it's largely in newspapers and the chatter that people offer up. And these are the reasons that were given by historians for many decades, too, which were, one, the Civil War was caused by radical abolitionists and their moral intolerance and their refusal to compromise. Two, was caused by the stubbornness of Southern politicians. Or three, that it had to do with the rights of the states as against the rights of the federal government. And Douglass just said, well, oh no, the reason that we're fighting this war is slavery. And he has this very powerful thing where he says, you can't place a shackle around a man's neck and not understand that the other end of that chain is shackled around your own. That slavery is a chain that binds on both ends. And that's what people fail to see and why they could imagine that the war was caused by something other than this dire institution. There are many proximate causes for the outcome of this election. Hillary Clinton was a terrible nominee. The DNC behaved badly. There is a rising tide of populism. There are changes in the media. There's a story of the FBI. There are a lot of proximate causes we might identify. But in the way that Douglass identified slavery as the ultimate and most meaningful cause of the war, as he saw it in 1862, that fundamentally it's economic inequality that is the deeper cause, the deeper reason for our troubles.
It was a brief but very powerful piece in The New Yorker you wrote. There was so much else in it, including Donald Trump getting something right. Can you spell that out?
So I went to the two conventions this summer.
Yeah.
To Cleveland and then to
Philadelphia. Simon Chalmers calls the archives of the feet for a historian. Get out there.
And it was fascinating and exhausting and weirdly exhilarating, but mostly depressing. But one of the things I found really striking about the coverage of the two conventions was how keenly people wanted to distinguish the one from the other. And they were not different to me in many, many ways.
Explain.
So how the Democrats positioned their convention in Philadelphia was the slogan was Love Trump's Hate. And they were therefore responding in a branding campaign that had been manufactured long before the Republican convention. They were responding to the idea that the Trump convention would be the convention of hate and theirs would be the convention of love. There was a lot of heart-shaped stuff in Philadelphia. So there's this weird sort of branding and packaging of love at the DNC that was, to me, just the mirror image of the just unbelievable amount of hate and aggression and viciousness and fiendishness at the RNC. I mean, if you go back and you watch that series of addresses from that stage, the kind of mongering of hatred for one another really was the currency of that convention. It wasn't as slickly branded as the "We Are the Party of Love," but I don't think saying "We Are the Party of Love" is an answer to "They Are the Party of Hate." It's actually a continuation of being a party of hate. It can't be a party ideology.
I have a sort of feeling that that political class is or ought to be in some sort of grave collapse of sort of overthinking, over-marketing, over-producing the business of
You might
of
think
our country.
That of the press as well, and yet I don't think they are. I went to that thing at the Kennedy School.
The
2-day campaign managers summit. First session was 20 campaign managers sitting around a big table, the 17 Republican campaigns and the 3 Democratic ones. In the evening, there was a media panel, the head of CNN, the Washington Post, the Associated Press, and Facebook News. I took careful notes. I listened to every word. I waited in vain for the breath, the gasp, the half sentence of remorse, regret, introspection. Nothing. Nothing. I was utterly unsurprised by that from the campaign managers. These people are political hacks. They really just went there to continue their campaigns and advance their careers.
Right.
And everything they said was self-interested.
I find this staggering. Everybody's blaming now at the level of...
fake news is the handy scapegoat for everybody.
Right.
Right, let's not think about what we have all done to contribute to this decay. Let's just think about who we can blame. So we can blame a bot in Eastern Europe.
Speak about, you know, a historian becoming a reporter in the moment. It's unfolding before your eyes. How did you like it? What did you learn that you hadn't known?
One of the pieces that I wrote this year that I was really glad that I wrote was actually about how people don't talk to people anymore, which is a piece I wrote about polling in the summer of 2015 and how the polling industry is dying for all kinds of reasons that we can understand that have to do with changing technologies, but that it should die. And actually, sadly, it should not be replaced with data science, but is. And that polling is a form of journalism fundamentally, and it has replaced journalists talking to people. We used to do these man-on-the-street interviews, kind of Kermit the Frog in a trench coat with a microphone and a pork pie hat, and we'd go around and just talk to people. And, you know, then we just get these little anecdotes, and that's completely passé, so old-fashioned. And at this point, there are no more reporters left to go do the man-on-the-street interviews. Think about the millions of hours of conversation that beat reporters had with people in pubs, the public library, the PTA meeting, the ballpark. Just asking people, so what do you think about that new referendum? You know, how do you think your neighborhood's going to go? And just talking to any schmo on the street, you would log hours doing that in order to write a piece, not predicting the outcome, but reporting what was going on. Those conversations are a glue. They're a glue that binds people together. And when you have instead data extraction, and then you're surprised that people feel atomized and alienated. The big error is under thinking that has to do with Donald Trump. You know, he's an after effect of that. But the atomization of the electorate, that's been decades in coming.
No, this is fascinating. And it addresses the big puzzle of who reports on the country anymore. The Washington Post had a story this week to the effect that Donald Trump outperformed Republicans in the counties with the highest mortality rates from drug overdose, alcohol, suicide, the deindustrialization diseases or the diseases of despair. That's a population that the media doesn't cover, obviously. It's part of what he intuited about the country, some basic unhappiness with these awful symptoms. What do you learn from that, from an intuitive and maybe very opportunistic and maybe demagogic reading of who we are? Beating the media, beating everybody.
I don't think he's beat everybody. Academics have been studying that for a really long time. It's not some genius intuitive insight of his. It is an incredible failing of the Democratic Party, among other things, and it is absolutely a failure of policymakers to address these problems in a meaningful way. What I think is significant about that feature of his victory is the difference between this populist moment and the populism of the 1890s, where what happened in the 1890s, when people were similarly left behind by industrialization and economic growth and development, and said, you know what? You all think progress is great. Progress is leaving us all behind. And some people said, how dare you critique progress? Progress is so great. Progress is our religion. But a lot of other people said, oh, they're right. The economic progress that we are experiencing has been leaving behind a lot of other people. And that's how populism became progressivism. You know, think about the muckraking journalist who called attention to the kind of political corruption right. that business interest was exerting on the political process. And that's how we end up with the primaries, among other things, from that moment. There are political reforms we may now say didn't turn out to be so brilliant, but people were listening and trying to come up with solutions. If you think about the populism of this second Gilded Age and the same thing happening, the numbers of people, types of people who are left behind by economic growth and are saying, what are you all talking about? Innovation, disruptive innovation, technological progress. What the an iPhone? Well, I have no job. What are you talking about? Mm. My kid is on heroin. We're dying here. What are you people even meaning? What are these fights that you're all having about? And what are the experts doing? They're not turning that populism to, they call themselves progressives. This becomes the way that the left answers the demonization of the word liberal. They resurrect the word progressive, and they found their super PACs, and they have their think tanks. But they're actually chiefly advancing the economic interests of their own class. And they're completely dazzled by Silicon Valley. The Silicon Valley are the robber barons of our day. And these people are not critics of that. They're not doing the kind of Louis Brandeis curse of bigness critique, except for someone like Elizabeth Warren or Sanders, right? I mean, that's what the appeal of those people. They're instead saying, isn't it just so great that we have these cool tools? We could use these tools to do other cool things. And you have people coming up with, the White House has its Office of Technology, and they're trying to think of how to use, data science to better track things that they don't even know about because they have not seen and visited and heard and suffered with and understood and reckoned with. So I think that is a real difference. And it is why this Democratic Party completely failed to reach those people. It's that Democratic Party that's taken by surprise by those people's misery because they've completely failed to understand it or reckon with it.
Coming up, a voice that's been rattling in my head for 8 years with a forethought about how the age of Obama might end. Don't you realize, the Italian scholar said, Obama is your Gorbachev, meaning a very good man who's been assigned an impossible task. This is Open Source. March 2009, a heady time just after Barack Obama's inauguration, a dire time post-meltdown, disarray in the global economy, in Europe, too. In an academic conference room, an Italian law professor I didn't know, Ugo Mattei, stood up with a big picture that electrified the meeting. Too many contradictions out there, he said. Technological arrogance in an impoverished world. Cold War over, but not Cold War thinking. Human sensibilities swamped by a digitized culture. China rising. Europe and the Euro floundering. Soviet Empire gone. American Empire on a losing streak. Obama, said Ugo Mattei, is your Gorbachev, meaning the West is coming apart, and if Obama can't save the regime, he might have to surrender it. Wacky words, I thought, but a sort of touchstone of possibility. So this week I called Ugo Mattei in Turin, where he teaches half the year, and I asked him to freshen his forecast today.
It's a kind of very transitional moment, it seems to me, in the sense that for the first time in a long period of time, the ratio of power between the public and the private is changed in favor of the second. And this is a transformation that is exceedingly important and was the consequence, in part a consequence of globalization, but mostly as a consequence of technological transformations. So today we have a situation in which a limited number of very strong economic private entities are much more powerful and effective than governments, and they are stronger than the law. And this is very, very new. It's probably the first time in which this is happening in our civilization. And lawyers and the legal structures have not realized it and didn't come to terms with that.
When you speak of a transitional moment, you don't mean Obama to Trump. You mean popular sovereignty to something else.
Popular sovereignty has been now for quite a long time a very nice illusion and a utopia. But right now, this is coming out in a very visible way. The formal equality is simply not working as a model of social organization. And so very powerful and rich private individuals are recognized as the only ones that are capable of some sort of agency in order to determine the direction in which the world is going. And this is why, you know, the strong man is emerging as a very popular figure practically everywhere. And this, of course, in the United States was very dramatic with the victory of Mr. Trump. But in Italy, we experienced that before. We had a very, very similar phenomenon with Silvio Berlusconi, who seized power in 1994 and was able to keep it for 20 years. And his popularity was fundamentally the idea that the guy was already very rich, very successful, and the only one who was strong enough to accomplish something. And if you think about Putin in Russia or Berlusconi in Italy or Mr. Trump in the United States, but we have similar things from the Philippines to Indonesia to Thailand. I mean, this is becoming a system of governance by strong men, because the sense is that only a strong man can actually protect us in some way.
Donald Trump makes it incredibly obvious in a way when he appoints ExxonMobil to represent the United States in the world. I mean, a company of unimaginable global reach and power and energy and wealth. What does it mean to have ExxonMobil as our Secretary of State?
It's a constitutional realignment of the political system to the economic reality. These corporations are stronger than governments. If you think about Goldman Sachs used to be a relatively small group of economic advisor of rich people, a partnership of a few individuals. Now is a huge corporation with hundreds of thousands of employees worldwide. And among these employees, there are basically a large number of public figures, prime ministers, presidents, former presidents, all working for Goldman Sachs. ExxonMobil, again, is one of these enormously powerful private entities that have been running the international politics for a long time. You know, after World War II, the big corporations have been growing and growing and growing, becoming more and more powerful. And now we are at the point in which there is a realignment of the actual constitutional structure. That's why we're talking about the crisis of liberal democracy. It is becoming, in a way, the political system is going to become closer to the economic substance and to the reality. And now these people are arriving to actually getting political roles. So, again, it's a constitutional transformation. It's a constitutional moment that is not only in one country or in a few countries, but is involving everybody and every country. It's some sort of a universal phenomenon of realignment of constitutional law to economic might.
But is it tyranny? Is it more of the same? Is it just changing the labels? Your oil company is now your government? Your bank is now your ruler, your president, or what?
Yes, I believe that this is the death of democracy. If you have a political system that is stronger than the corporations, okay, or at least arguably stronger than the corporations, then the people's focus on the political campaigns, for example, or who is going to run the government is meaningful. But if the government is not capable anymore of imposing its rules on large corporations, then whatever happens at the government level seems irrelevant. And to me, you know, we were talking about Obama last time we talked together. The Obama administration has been the clear example of how a, so to say, democratic, or at least someone who actually has some values of democracy in office, is completely incapable of determining any kind of process, because the processes are determined elsewhere. Mm. And the guy has been unable to accomplish anything, and the people understand that. And because they understand that, then the next time they're not going to vote for someone who is on the same line of fundamental impotency, and are trying to look for some hope in someone who is actually can be really mighty, okay? So the really mighty one is actually pointing other real mighty people. In the United States, in the government, I think that there is no one guy who is not a billionaire who is in government. I think it is a convergence between the former very mighty organization of state capitalism in the Soviet Union, for example, that after the fall of the Berlin Wall, for a while we thought that the big vertical structure of the firm, that was the Soviet economy, would have disappeared in favor of some sort of a market system that which is more decentralized. But in fact, the market system is centralized itself now, and it is changing the whole game. The lawyers are completely impotent. Legislators produce laws that are never in the public interest, in the interest of everybody. They're always in the interest of the strong private actors, and people is frustrated. So instead of being angry to, you know, against the very mighty, they become actually fond of them. They become very angry to the very weak. You know, instead of being mad at the telecom that cheats you on your bills and that puts their hands in your pockets and creates a lot of social stress to you and all of these kind of things, people get mad to the immigrants, you know. The target is wrong.
This sounds very radical. At the same time, I'm thinking Donald Trump might endorse everything you're saying. I mean, he's made it very, very obvious. We're going to have a government of billionaires and giant corporations, the biggest, and generals, and that's it.
I'm sure that Donald Trump would like this analysis because it's completely describing his success. The question is, if we pretend it's not like this, then we are not going to be able to develop any sort of counter-narrative or resistance to try to make things go in a different way. You know, Chris, the point is that this cannot go on forever. I mean, this extractive moment, this model of development is very, very unsustainable. The ecological footprint is crazy.
Ugo Maté, I'm so glad you remember our conversation almost exactly 8 years ago at the start of the Obama administration. The meltdown was still news. And I've never forgotten three things you told me about that. One, that unless the West regrouped in a totally radical way, China would win, in effect, the meltdown. But second, that we would confront a crisis not just of money, but of civilization and the regime that was bigger than the financial crisis. And third, that Barack Obama would turn out to be our Gorbachev, a good man put in to save a crumbling regime and didn't quite make it.
I still think that the analysis was pretty right. I mean, it proved that, you know, was a good man and he was incapable of stopping the crazy acceleration toward final destruction. And now there is, you know, Donald Trump that might be the one who actually is just... Donald Trump is a post-democratic leader. So the liberal democratic model, which was what Obama was the last president of, is completely dead. And now we are in the post-democratic era, globally. So keeping thinking about the usual categories of democracy that were considered married with capitalism in some way, you know, during the last 30, 40 years, now just it's crumbled. And so the good man tried to save a facade of respect and of humanism. He had his own share of very questionable international strategies, like, you know, throwing drones on the head of people and doing the kind of stuff that he's been doing internationally. I'm not saying that Obama deserved the Nobel Prize for Peace or anything like that. But certainly he was a good man in the sense that he really tried his best to save a constitutional order that was the constitutional order of liberal democracy. And Trump despises this constitutional order of liberal democracy. He realized it is just impotent. And there is a very interesting convergence to me that is going on between the government model of Mr. Putin and the one of Donald Trump. I was one of these people that when Clinton lost the elections, I was some sort of relieved because I was very scared of a confrontation between the United States and Russia happening again. With the victory of Trump, I don't think there is going to be any kind of that risk anymore. But we have to pay as some sort of a consideration of avoiding a clash of civilization between the Western democracy and the autocracy, the fact that also the West became autocratic. This is where we are. I mean, there is no country in the West today in which democracy is something more than a facade, a discourse, or an ideology, but most of the leaders have been working hard in concentrating more and more the power into the executive. We are in an executive phase. which means a phase of concentration of power in one guy.
And as you say, in private entities too.
Exactly. The private entities has always been structured that way. The CEO is the dictator of the corporation. The CEO decides, and then a chain very effectively transmits the orders of the CEO all the way down to the last employee of the chain. This very same structure was the structure of the Soviet model, which was a gigantic firm, which included the whole Soviet economy from the top to the bottom. It was called democratic centralization, which had nothing of democratic, was just centralization. And now what is happening, it seems to me, is that the liberal democratic model, of which Obama was the last champion, has collapsed, not only in the United States, but also in the United States. And the model of the firm, which is the business model of the private corporation, had taken over also the public organization of power. And so in that kind of a model, you know, the outcome is a vertical concentration of power in the hands of a strong man that, you know, we can call fascism, we can call communism, we can call the way we want. Of course, we need other and new categories, but it seems to me that this is exactly the result of this change of the power ratio between the private and the public I was talking about at the beginning of our conversation.
You say it's the end of constitutional democracy, but nothing ever dies that way. First, because, as you say, an extractive model of development can't go on forever. But also, we can feel a kind of political counter-movement gathering even now. You've said from the beginning that what the world needs is a humanistic recovery.
Yes.
What would that look like?
Humanism means change direction. We need to structure our institutions in such a way that some of that enormous amount of capital that we have can get transformed into commons. But we cannot do that if we keep the same rules of the game we had so far, in the law especially. I really believe that if we want to change our direction in the direction of humanism, we need to get an approach to the law which is ecological, which is decentralized, which gives power back to communities, and which works on patterns of inclusion of communities, one with the other, rather than on patterns of territorial exclusion. We need narratives that create, recreate community, recreate commons, recreate ways in which people are together. Because if you resist alone, you end up in jail. If you resist in many people, then you change the world. Okay? That's the difference. And there must be some sort of a principle that allows people to get together, to understand that the direction is wrong now because we are violating fundamental laws of reproduction of life on the planet. And as it used to be in the 17th century when there was a collective duty of resistance. And it seems to me that there is a huge role for intellectuals and for people that are actually trying to make people understand that we are not flying, but we are actually crashing. To put it very simply, what happened in this last century was a transformation from the citizen to the consumer to the commodity. Okay, so we started as citizens and now we are commodities. And now we have to go back. We have to go back to ideas of citizenship, but ideas of citizenship that are not individual rights, but that are collective duties. Because otherwise we are going to be commodified, and we are already commodified quite a lot. Think about, you know, our value as producers of big data, as, you know, workers for free by, you know, posting on Facebook or by, you know, contributing for free to the extraction of the new digital economy. All of that has to change.
All sorts of Americans are wondering, really scratching their heads every day collectively about how do we regroup? Give them a short assignment list.
I think that, you know, Americans should stop to believe that life is a competition of one against the other, should stop thinking that cooperating and collaborating is cheating. You know, you guys are kind of socialized from the very beginning of schools on this idea that, you know, there is some sort of individual task of being you know, the best student, and that all the other students are potential competitors. Competition is one of the most fundamental aspects of the American psyche, that have to be overcome. Life is about cooperation, is cooperative dance. Life is about caring of each other. We are in the business of living together in the same planet. We have to transfer this planet to future generations. We have to accomplish tasks together. So go out there, greet your neighbors, share your problems, be inclusive. Each one of us, in every one of our contexts, has to put some thoughts about how to give rather than how to extract, how to transmit knowledge, and how to put some of the energy at the service of the community rather than on yourself alone.
Ugo Maité likes to say he learned his politics in the school of Antonio Gramsci, a hero of the anti-fascist left in Italy in the 1920s and 30s. Professor Maté teaches the other half of the year at the University of California's Hastings College of Law in San Francisco. He's easy to find on the web and on our site at radioopensource.org. Coming up, Roberto Unger is a Brazilian original, for 50 years a non-conforming legend at the Harvard Law School, where he writes endlessly on theology, philosophy, and politics. A political reversal on the scale of Donald Trump's election, Professor Unger is telling me, is the only opportunity for the voice of democratic prophecy to speak in America again. This is Open Source. Putting the Trump transition in a grand context, Roberto Unger has taught generations of up-and-comers, Barack Obama among them, at the Harvard Law School. But what do they take away? The core, I'm guessing, is his ecstatic devotion to a line of thinking associated with Ralph Waldo Emerson, the infinitude of the private mind and soul, radical pragmatism on the ground. The glory of American politics, Unger says, is the greatness of the ordinary. The enemy is the naturalization of littleness. In his office this week, Roberto Unger told me, the Trump moment is above all an opportunity for the rest of us to rise to the occasion.
The salient characteristic of the United States is an immense vitality, a vitality expressed in every aspect of national life, a vast, disorganized, unlimited energy. And the tragedy of the country, as of my country, Brazil as well, the country that's most like the United States, is the denial to the vast majority of people of the instruments and opportunities with which to make something of this energy. So this vast intensity, and much of it goes to waste. So the overriding goal of the progressives in the past, in modern history, has not been greater quality. It has been the elevation of the life and powers and experience of ordinary men and women to a higher level. The central idea in politics is the idea of greatness. And the aim of a progressive politics is only secondarily the humanization of society. It's primarily the divinization of humanity. It's the elevation of ordinary life to a higher plane. So that's where I would begin. The Democratic Party failed to develop a sequel to Roosevelt's New Deal. And given that the ordinary American was not being defended by the supposed progressives, a vacuum was produced, a big emptiness, because neither of the two major political forces developed a project responsive to the needs, interests, and longings of this majority of the country. This vacuum in a semi-democracy like the United States, with a relatively rigid class system and vast inequalities, invites an adventurer. And in the history of politics, one of the classic forms of the adventurer is the plutocrat. It's not a recent invention. The ancient Romans knew all about it. What you could say is that this is better than the alternative.
Do you say that?
I say that as an admirer of the United States, a friend of American democracy. I think that what happened...
And a voter in Brazil, right?
And a voter in Brazil. What happened was better than the alternative. And always the question is the alternative. It's better than the alternative because it throws this vacuum open. And it affirms the power of politics. It destabilizes the situation. It brings to power a bunch of people who see things raw and have the advantage of being less prejudiced than the professors and the ideologues of the technocratic centrism that preceded them. What I'm saying is that in this historical moment, the rupture, the discontinuity established by the populist moment creates an opportunity. An opportunity for transformation if the opportunity is seized.
Come back to a line of yours that intrigued me, that only a political reversal, and we've had one, only a political reversal, you said, can allow the voice of democratic prophecy to speak again.
Yes.
And you said, speaking is always risky, but not to speak is death. Okay. How would you get from there to the sort of structural change that you thought this was a responsible bet? Bet on Trump.
Politics, when it is serious, I'm not defending the bet on Trump. I emphasize that. What I'm saying is that in this circumstance, the rupture that happened may be better than the alternative to it, than the continuity of the technocratic centrism.
When it sounds like a bet on Trump, and you were ready to bet on Romney against Barack Obama in 2012.
No. I was more interested in the defeat than in the election of that candidate, that other candidate. But that's another circumstance.
You're a one-time student once upon a time, no? Barack Obama.
He was my student.
What happened?
What do you mean, what happened? You have to ask him what happened.
What's your view?
He was never very different, in my impression, from what he later became. So we shouldn't, again, individualize the fault.
Meaning what, though? He was a very bright student, but do you mean an accommodator to excess?
Yes, he was not out to shake the country and to reinvent Roosevelt and to create an alternative. And it's a futile enterprise to imagine the reconstruction of a personality. I've learned in my own experience of engagement that it's easier to change a country than it is to change a person. To change a country, you have to be only a statesman. To change a person, you have to be something greater than that. Politics, when it's serious, is always both political and religious, if by religion we mean consciousness. And when I said those words about the American prophets, I had in mind Lincoln and Whitman and Emerson. And what was their prophecy? Their prophecy was the prophecy of the greatness of the ordinary person.
The infinitude of the private man, Emerson said.
The infinitude, the God in ruins, the transcendence over the circumstance. That's the essential faith of democracy. And for it to be serious, this vision of the heightening of our powers has to be married to a program of cumulative institutional change. So I want a high-energy democracy. I want a democracy whose institutions organize a high level of popular engagement in political life.
Ugo Mattei is talking about an end of democracy, a capture of politics. You're talking about a reinvention of politics, a new possibility for a different democracy, a more energized democracy. How do we mediate those two views?
You can't mediate those two views. That view is a view of despair, which then fails to understand the constant transformative opportunities that history is providing us with. So one of the virtues of politics is that it surprises. It doesn't act according to script. And everything that's useful in the world happens when we throw the script out. But that's not a salvation. That's just, as it were, a crack. And the question is what we do with it. And to do something with it, we then have to organize an alternative agenda, another set of ideas, and another set of movements. The main challenge is to the rest of us, to the Americans, who then have to ask themselves, what will they do with the next stage of their national politics?
I'm also thinking, though, of the anxiety level in this society today. Ordinary people, I know a lot of them, who feel really pretty desperate. Is that a good cautionary impulse, or is it just that we're so unused to political risk and, as you would say, a high-energy politics?
Well, in this world, if we're serious and understand ourselves, we all feel somewhat desperate because everyone is belittled in relation to what he can be and should be. So the experience of belittlement is a universal experience. It's part of our situation. But this has a special meaning in democracy and under American democracy, because the central idea of democracy is the idea of the greatness of the ordinary.
Help us reimagine the possibilities. We're stuck in a lot of bad old ruts, including, in my view, the sort of imperial America.
So the technocratic centrists had as another dimension of their thinking and their activity a commitment to the doctrine of liberal imperialism, the imposition of a Metternichian order on the world. This was a huge incubus, not only on humanity, but on the American people. There's some suggestion now that this incubus will be, if not overthrown, at least lightened, and that the Americans will be able to think in another way of the relation between the transformation of the country and the organization of the world, in which they will cease to have an imperial role. They will not police the world.
An exemplary role, maybe.
Exemplary role is what we all hope to have. But we have to earn it by self-transformation.
That's what Burke hoped for the British Empire. An empire with a notion of imperial justice.
Well, we Democrats think that empires don't deserve to be exemplary, and that every empire will be brought down into the dust. So I hope that the American people will not allow American democracy to be wedded to empire. And
it's a little late in the game, but I'm with you.
It's not late in the game. It's not late in the game.
When you've got 900 military bases around the world.
Yes, I know. But it was late in the game that this marriage of democracy to imperialism took place. And the American people should get rid of it. They should dissolve this marriage. Now, none of this is about this Trump regime, right? These plutocratic populists. It's about the moment which their ascent has produced in the history of the country. So it's about the opportunity that the American people now have to reinvent themselves.
Yeah. Make America great again.
Greatness is the central idea in politics. The plutocrat had a crude intuition of it, which his technocratic or social democratic predecessors did not.
Is that promising? His Chinese hat makers had the same idea.
The idea is available to all of humanity until it's suppressed by these pieties and renunciations of the dominant form of thought. So the enemy here is the naturalization of littleness. Now what the Americans want is a chance to get into the action and to the real work instead of make work, to the fun, to the movement, to the creation, to the construction. The dominant force in politics is always the force that most plausibly embodies the cause of constructive energy. If the leftists or the progressives take the position of simply humanizing the constructive or energetic proposals of their conservative adversaries, which is what they've done in the North Atlantic world, then they've already lost. And they've become just the normalizers or the softeners of the program of their adversaries. So I want a different kind of left. I want a different kind of progressive. And in the American situation, retakes the voice of the American prophets, criticizes the content of their message, and develops a program of cumulative institutional change in the organization of the market economy and of American democracy.
Okay, illustrate it. When you think of unleashing or reinventing or rediscovering, reappreciating the genius in the country, what comes to your mind?
Everything in the United States. I think one of the most remarkable features of the American people is their ability to cooperate across class lines, across racial lines. Take an example of a forgotten, misunderstood example, which is the war economy in the United States, the way the American economy was organized in the Second World War. Mm. When they needed to, the Americans discarded this ideological regime, this institutional system that they're supposedly wedded to, and did everything differently. So the economy for 4 years between 1941 and 1945 was organized on the basis of fluid cooperation between the state and private enterprise. Oligopolies took advantage of this, to be sure. The top rate of the marginal rate of the personal income tax was over 90%, inconceivable to Americans who are living today. Everything was different. In 4 years, from 1941 to 1945, GDP in the United States doubled. It was the fastest growth rate that the Americans had ever achieved, and they did it by violating all of the precepts of their sacrosanct economic doctrines. When they needed to, they could cooperate. They could do things differently under the pressure of necessity. I don't want them to need to have a world war to reinvent themselves. We have to find another incitement. But they've already demonstrated in their history that they have this capacity for self-reinvention.
What William James, child of Emerson, said, the moral equivalent of war. That's what we're looking for, it sounds like.
We want a social order that gives us a better chance to be both great and sweet, to be connected with one another, to be doing something larger than it. That's the object of politics. That's what it's for. It's not just a business about marginal adjustments and small material improvements. And that goes to the heart of the American faith. That's the prophetic element. The Protestant Reformation had the idea of the priesthood of all believers. Democracy asserts the idea of the prophetic powers of all citizens, of all people. And to be real, to be not just a floating spirit, it has to be embodied in a form of economic and political organization. A high-energy democracy that gives people a chance to share in the organization of the context in which they live, and a market economy which allows them to create, to innovate, to invent, to disrupt in the ordinary prosaic business of life.
You don't sound worried at all about the end of anything.
What is the end? The end is for us to live in such a way that we die only once.
And did you just make that up? No. Somebody said that.
No, that's a deeply held belief of mine. And it's intimately related to this creed of democracy. Hmm. Democracy is about the constructive genius of the ordinary. The highest good is life, is vitality. And we want a structure which, rather than subordinating it to conformity, to routine, to repetition, allows it to thrive. And then we increase our share in the attributes that we ascribe to the divine. That's the bridge between political hope and spiritual hope.
Roberto Unger, this is hugely refreshing here at the Harvard Law School, which may not get to nominate anybody for the Supreme Court again in our time.
If the American people are lucky.
It's come from sorrow in the street, the holy places where the races meet, from the homicidal bitching that goes down in every kitchen to determine who will serve and who will eat, from the wells of disappointment where the women kneel to pray for the grace of God in the desert here, in the desert far away. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Thank you, Professor Unger, and Ugo Maté, and Jill Lepore. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, and Frank Horton. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.